This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league, starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My guest today is actor, filmmaker, and podcast host Rob Lowe. You may know him from The West Wing and St. Elmo's Fire. By the way, iconic show and movie. But today, Rob is the star of Fox's 911 Lone Star and host of Literally with Rob Lowe. This is Just Me with Rob Lowe. Let's get into it. Hi. So I talked to you, a lot of people commented on me doing your show. Like, isn't it funny the types of people that come out of the woodwork when you do different things and then you realize why you do different things?
Yes, I'm so interested to know. You did my podcast Literally and you were great. I had a great talk with you. What was the reaction on your end?
The reaction was great, but like I said, from different people that I don't, you know, you're always marketing to the same audience because they're your audience. And so right. that's why the model of podcasts and doing different types of things and having different people on yours does really work, because different, like random, like David Lasher, who was Vinny from Blossom, was like, I listened to you on Rob Lowe's. I'm like, what? Like, it was just so weird. All of it. I was like, oh, and he's like, I loved what you said. It was so inspirational. And I know him. And he's like, I didn't even know your story. So, you know, it hit differently, which is nice, which says a lot about you and the combination of us who are in a similar generation, but speaking to some similar people. And then I'm sure, you know, different people, but I enjoyed it. I feel like I know you now. And I was in Santa Barbara recently. And I felt like I know Rob Lowe. I'm in Santa Barbara. I have friends here.
I love hearing that. And I, it's true, isn't it? Like, it is always interesting to me when we are out giving interviews or selling a product or a movie or TV or whatever, who is watching or listening to what. It's endlessly fascinating to me. Like,
yeah. I mean, I really do think that I'm not a person who likes unsolicited advice or visits, but if I were that person and I feel like if I knocked on your door, you'd be like, hey, come on in. I feel like we're friends now. So
you are 100%. I'm already feeling bad that you didn't say, hey, I'm in Santa Barbara. Let's get coffee.
I think I messaged on Instagram, but I don't know if you got it. I forget if like,
my Instagram, I'm not as good as following the comments maybe as I should be.
Yeah, no, I don't, believe me. I mean, I went with my daughter. We stayed at Calamigos Ranch in Malibu and then drove for the day.
Oh, what's that like to stay there?
So Mark Gervitz is a power comedy manager who lives in Malibu, like deep Malibu. There's Malibu and then there's like deeper Malibu.
Yes.
And I was going to an event at his house to see Adam Sandler and a bunch of people. And I wanted to have a staycation versus stay in LA where you're going to transact and you're going to be in the business of show. And I wanted to be on a vacation and feel like I could go to the beach, and Malibu's different. So we stayed at this place, Calamigos Ranch, which is like very ranchy and very Malibu-ish and very cowboy boot-ish and rustic and different than most of LA. And everybody that I've told that I stayed there was like, oh, yeah, no, I've never stayed there, or I've never been there. And I was like, what do you mean? It was shocking. Yeah. So I loved it.
When I was a kid, when I was in junior high, that everybody went to summer camp at Calamigos Ranch. And it's been different things. It's been a proper ranch, and then it's been defunct, and then it's been revitalized, but I've never stayed there.
So then we went to your town, and I love that town of Santa Barbara. I've been to Montecito and we did that, but like that street in Santa Barbara with all those pianos on it was amazing.
I know, right? Since COVID, they shut down State Street, and it's now like a plaza, a walking plaza. Those are two of my favorite places, Malibu and Montecito and Santa Barbara. Three of my favorite, I should say.
Likewise. Okay. So I've done a little bit of reading about you, and I had always peripherally gotten a sense of you. Like I knew you married a makeup artist or your makeup artist. And I was sadly jealous at the time. And I was just thinking like, why her, not me? And I didn't even know you. So that was a good reason why we didn't know each other. So we talked on your podcast about this a little bit, but you started in, you were in Ohio and then you went to LA, or you started in Virginia?
Yeah, I was born in Charlottesville, where my dad had just graduated from law school. And then my mother and my dad moved to Dayton, and that's where I had my childhood. My proper, from 6 months old to 12 was in Dayton. So I got a real Midwestern childhood. And then my mom and dad divorced, and we ended up in directly from Dayton to Point Doom in Malibu, which was like going to Mars.
Wow. That's Fred Heyman from Giorgio Beverly Hills. I planned and organized his wedding. And so that was my first experience with Point Doom.
Yeah. Point Doom there's Malibu and then there's Point Doom. It's a whole different vibe. And my great obsession is I want to do a movie or miniseries or a book about what life was like in Malibu, but on Point Doom in particular in the mid to late 70s, because it was nuts.
Wait, so hold on. I was staying when you went down to the left was Paradise Cove, and then to the right. Point Doom is not in Malibu. It's like its own thing.
No, it's a part of Malibu, but it's because it's a point.
Okay.
It's its own neighborhood. It's not on the PCH like everything else is. And it's just a weird, I don't know if it's the Indian Chumash mojo there, but it's both really exciting and interesting and really dark and weird all at the same time.
Are there reservations there?
No, but
okay.
But it's all real Chumash, the original, people of the area. It's very vibey in that way. Lots of arrowheads and history.
What high school did you go to?
There was no high school in Malibu then. There was, there is now. And we had to take the bus 22 miles to Santa Monica to go to high school.
So you went to Santa Monica High School. Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you really, but I mean, starting at 12, you kind of really are a California boy, and you really never left that sphere. Like you're not that far from there now. I mean, you're in that vibe too. There's a Malibu vibe. And I feel like Santa Barbara is like a Malibu adjacent vibe, having spent that weekend wanting to go that way versus go the other way into LA.
Yeah, for sure. And again, when I moved there, it was not a show business enclave. It is now. There was a time, I would say in the early 80s when the studio executives and the agents all moved out there. But when I grew up there, it's what Santa Barbara and Montecito were when I moved up here, which is super rural. People ride their horses down the street.
Wow.
Not a company town. You get all walks of life. When you, if I'm coaching Little League, there's the dads work in every line of work you could imagine, and they're not all in show business. So I'm attracted to a little bit of more diversity of thought and of experience.
And moving your kids to Santa Barbara when they were at an age where things are more influential. That was obviously intentional. Is that because of your Midwestern roots? Like you just wanted to feel some version of that?
Yeah, I wanted them to be able to be outside a lot. I wanted, you know, up here we could go to the beach, maybe take a hike, have go to the zoo and go to a movie. We could do that all in one day up here. And in LA, as you know, that's, you could do one of them,
right,
in a day. And if you're in Malibu, you can really only do one of them.
And where's your wife from?
She's a born and bred Valley girl.
She's a Valley girl. Okay. And
Valley, she is a Valley girl, you know, Hollywood. She grew up in both areas.
So you dragged her?
I dragged her.
You dragged her.
Yeah, she was not having it. I had a real vision though. Every once in a while I have a vision of what I want to do, not all the time, but every once in a while. And I really was like, this is really right for us. And it's one of the smartest things that we ever did as a family was move up here. Both, I mean, in terms of our lifestyle, what it did for our relationships, for our marriage, for our kids, and financially, as it turns out, more than anything, I've done better in real estate in Montecito than I've done in my entertainment career.
That's what the next question I was going to ask is, did you invest? And did you invest early?
Yep, I did.
And, years ago.
Yep. And Montecito continued to become more attractive. And then between people being able to work from home, the rise of Zoom, the experience of COVID, and a big hotel opening up, the Miramar, that brought people from all over the world to see it, and Meghan and Harry moving in, all of those things turned Montecito into another version of the Hamptons, which it never was.
You said last time when I spoke to you that you don't, I don't think you consider yourself a very good business person, or do you?
Oh, it depends. I definitely consider myself a business person, for sure.
You do? Okay.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Like you're thinking business first, you're marketing your business, you have a chessboard that you're working in your mind.
Oh, 100%. I mean, it doesn't supersede my creative, but I like to think that I can get them both to exist equally within me, and neither one is a detriment to the other.
And so when you started making money acting, you started investing, or that was just you buying your personal property? Like, what was your business trajectory?
It was really just buying the personal property, really. And then, you know, selling it and, you know, doing well and moving up the ladder, and then selling that and doing well. And then starting to invest in other areas of real estate, which is really, and I got to give my wife credit. She has really been the impetus behind that.
Behind the investing in other real estate.
In real estate, period. She's got an amazing, amazing sniffer for real estate.
The vision of what something could be.
Yes, insane.
Yeah.
Like, just insane.
I love that. And I've done that personally a lot. And it was almost unintentional, but during the pandemic, I flipped 3 places. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about you talking about your personal real estate for people who are thinking about business in different ways. For me, anytime I go to look at something, I always think about, even if it's for an investment, if I would live there. Because if the shit hits the fan and you have 5 different pieces on the board, you could sell 4 and you'd be willing to live in any of them. Like, they all work for you. I like that freedom of thought where,
yes,
I like that. But if I end up not liking it, like a place on the water, maybe I don't know what it's like to live on the water, but I fantasize about it. Yeah. I just bought a place, but I know I could move it or rent it. I like to be nimble in the pieces like that.
Yeah, and for us, the straight investment real estate is new-ish. And, you know, we weren't flippers, and we're not. Our homes are our homes, and we live in them, but we've just had those things where people have said, you know, we'd like to buy it, and you name the price. And I go, you know what? At the end of the day, I'm still an actor for hire. I sort of have a fiduciary responsibility to my family to say yes to this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like I ever build any home to flip it.
Right. I understand. But your wife is probably thinking of things being somewhat not neutral, but I think people think about that in design too. You know, yes. You're not putting like crocodile walls because you never know what could happen if someone knocks on the door.
Oh yeah. Oh, well, listen, for sure. And I think it's one of the reasons we have been able to do what we've do is when we just found a big, an amazing piece of property. It's a legacy property, been around since 1877. And when you have something like that, you have to build something on it that's equal to the property. And if you don't, then you're actually taking money off the table. So it's a weird thing. If you're going to spend more, but you're actually making more than if you know what I mean? It's like,
yes, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to do it right. Yeah. I live on a house that's 1743 on a property with an apple orchard. And like, I don't mess around with the original wood in the house or like, you have to honor it. This is what you're saying. You're honoring. Okay. You're not going to like spec house it up on an 1800s property.
Yeah.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. Love this. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs on demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. Visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So you've done well. You've made money in show business and in real estate. How do you? I know you have sons, and that you wanted to move them there to for them to have this sort of balance and be grounded. How do you raise rich kids? Because I've talked to Mark Cuban about this. I've talked to myself about this. And has it worked? And are your kids, you know, well-adjusted, work for themselves? Like, did you do this? Did you nail it?
Well, first of all, you know, it's all relative. Even what is rich, right, is relative. You know, Mark Cuban's got a lot more money than you or I do.
But even the guy, he still doesn't want really, really, really asshole spoiled kids. So it's harder for him because he's flying on a private plane. We're flying first class. So like at your level, I guess, you know?
Well, first of all, I think my kids, if you ask them, they legitimately would not consider themselves rich. That's not in the ethos. Like, they know they have this trust fund, or they know that I know people like this. I've worked with people like, who know that when their dad or mom kicks the bucket, or when grandpa kicks the bucket, they're coming into, you know, a lot of money. They you know, it's always out there in their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously that's not my family. I think that they grew up thinking and having certainly the experience of being not any different than a lot of the other kids, other than, you know, maybe the vacations were nicer. And, you know, like you said, maybe we flew more often. But I tried to give them a really normal, to the extent I could, upbringing. I think the thing that makes it really different is the fame part of it.
Oh, interesting. Okay, right.
You know, because, you know, you can be worth $4 billion and you can walk into a restaurant and nobody knows who you are. Mm-hmm. And you can be worth, you know, $400,000 and walk into a restaurant and it stops dead in its tracks. So it's a funny thing. So I really think there's the, how do you deal with money? And then there's, how do you deal with being in a family that is in the public eye?
And are you insular? You're not out that much, or you live in a place where no one cares? And, you know, what's it like when you're with them in LA? Do they care? What is that like in your house? Fame? And is your wife annoyed by it?
Well, the thing is, one of the reasons I consciously moved out of LA was I didn't want my kids growing up, you know, around paparazzi and where the currency of the realm is your fame. And that just is what it is in LA. There's no way to skin that cat.
Mm-hmm.
When I grew up in Malibu, there were horses at the hitching posts at the market. They're gone, and they're replaced with paparazzi staking people out, which wasn't there. So mm-hmm. I recreated it. So they just didn't, they'd come home and go, Dad, they'd visit a friend in Malibu, Dad, they had a screening room. We watched a movie there and Jim Carrey came over and they're talking like they're from, you know, Ohio.
Right.
You know, and I was like, yeah, that's good. They should have stars in their eyes like that and feel that way. And, you know, my son is the actor, didn't start out that way. He started out as a stem cell scientist and went to Stanford and then came out and decided he wanted to be an actor and a writer. And of course that was not a happy day for me. I was like,
here we go.
Look at that, a molecular biologist.
Yeah.
I have an actor.
My daughter kind of acts like when she went from this public school to this private school, she acted like she was sort of on scholarship. She was like, oh my God, Mom, they give free art supplies. And she was so excited. And I think that's because, you know, just because I buy things that I want or I worked hard to get all this, it doesn't mean it's a free for all. And I have all these rules that, you know, if you really want something, you have to give something up or you have to work for it. And it is a discipline. Like, I do really work really hard at it, and I do have to pull on the reins a lot. And I like that. I think it's like, it feels like a project. Like, your kids are the best possible project. It's, you get such a ROI on the time you invest in them and these kind of principles. And you can be struggling financially and have spoiled kids.
For sure. Entitled, spoiled. You know, it happens. It can happen to kids anywhere. You know,
yeah.
it really absolutely. Entitlement is I think the worst element of it. But I also think that they take their cues from their parents. And, you know, I work my ass off. And so does Cheryl Lowe. I mean, she literally this week flew to Washington for her jewelry business, came home, and last night flew to Arizona and came home. And she's out there on the floor selling at Neiman Marcus, doing her thing. It's like, she doesn't have to do that.
No, but yeah. And have you ever, like, was there, it's my turn in your relationship because it's been very much about you and your career. Was there it's my turn after her, you know, helping you raise the kids and all that, or it's just always been an ebb and flow?
It's always been that way. I mean, one of the reasons I married her was she had this, and remains, she has the strongest work ethic of anybody I've ever known. And that's saying something, because mine is strong. And so whether it's raising the kids or starting a makeup line or building the homes that we have, she also has from time to time built for other people. She has always worked. She will always work.
Like, interesting. And so your work ethic comes from your upbringing and your family, right?
Yeah.
I think
part of it's genetic, because my mom was sort of very artsy and not really a worker. My dad is 84 and still goes into the office, practices law. My grandpa, who is very close to my mom's side, just a eighth grade education, you know, became the first millionaire in his city. So it's kind of in the DNA a little bit, maybe.
So you were always working your ass off? Like, you're working as hard as you were when you were younger? Like, you were always this way?
Paper routes, you know, bus boy. I mean, I did get fired from every job that I had that wasn't around show business, because I'm not really cut out for the real world, Bethany.
but you're cut out for show business and, well, I guess real estate. You're cut out for non-traditional business.
Yes, 100%. I designed my entire life to try to not deal with math. And, you know, listen, that I'm really good on the other side of my brain, and I've really learned a lot about, I can get by with numbers, obviously, because you have to if you're going to be in any kind of a business, but I avoid it. It's not my jam. I don't like it. I appreciate people who do. I'm very much a creative person with a, you know what it's like when people say, do you sing? It's like, I'm an actor who sings, which is very different than being a singer who acts or a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that way with business. I am a storyteller, entertainer, producer, director, writer, show, who also is in business.
Right. When you were partying, how could you have that same work ethic? Or you were just partying and then you would wake up and you would just be hurting a little, but you always had the same work ethic, just exhausted and a little stripped.
Exactly. When I'm out at, you know, Danceteria at the Hamptons till, 4 o'clock in the morning and I got to get up to shoot Masquerade. You just suck it up and go.
Yeah. I get that.
Also, it's a little bit of like, you emulate your idols. And, you know, my idols today are really, really different than they were then. But then, you know, it was like Jack Nicholson, man, he's out partying. He's at the Roxy, you know, with the shades on at 2 a.m. And then he's on the set of The Witches of Eastwick, man. Mm-hmm. Courtside at the Laker games. He lives up on Mulholland. And he's got 17 girlfriends, man. Yeah. Like, that was what I thought was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In many ways, the younger generation, I worry about them, but not in that way. I think they're more evolved in wanting to feel good and drinking matcha and acai, and whether it all works or not, I don't know. But they're aware of like well-being and balance, where we were not. But I'm the same as you. It's a pros play hurt model.
Yes, yes.
Tough shit.
One hundo. Same with my wife. Same and you know, little and John Owen, my acting son, you know, he's very open about it. He's also sober. And he was the same. He was like, pros play hurt.
Right.
Work hard, play hard.
Yeah. But now it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be so exhausting. It's okay to feel good. So sobriety is a major, major role in your career,
and in our family's life, for sure. Major. Well, I wouldn't have anything without it. Really, what it is I think it would have been just the law of diminishing returns. I would have been like the frog that slowly gets boiled alive in the water as you incrementally. You just, you know, can't feel it and just,
yeah,
that would have been me with my, you know, personal life and career.
Like death by 1,000 paper cuts. It was just like, was it really hard to quit everything? Or was it like, there are 50 shades of addiction. I've taken classes on it. And some people are bingers. Some people, it's just always in their life. They call it a French type alcoholic. And some people really hit rock. So what was your relationship to substances?
Mine was, I was kind of a periodic, they would say. And so you're up at Charlie Sheen's pool and you got your Coronas and you're working out at the gym, you're being tough, and then you have a couple of Coronas, and then the next thing you know, you're looking for the blow or whatever, maybe because it's nighttime and you go out to, and then you're chasing girls around and it's like you're 20, you're 19, 20, 21 years old. And that was sort of the vibe for me. And I just at a certain point realized that I was never going to have the life I wanted continuing that. And so, when I was ready, I went to Sierra Tucson and it was the best thing I ever did. And I actually loved being in rehab. I loved it. I learned so much. I was always a pleasure to have in class in school. I always was. Okay. I was that in the
front. Absorbing.
I'm in the front row, raising my hand. That was always me. And I was the same in rehab. And I learned a ton. And, you know, by the grace of God, I've never had to slip. I've never had to go back. I got from the minute I got sober, I've stayed sober. That was 33 years ago.
Because you work your ass off. So you work your ass. But is it a struggle now, or it's just what it is?
No,
right?
It's in my DNA. DNA. Listen, being, you know, having the ism is a struggle because it's like whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
You know, like every decade I realize it's morphed into something else that I need to look at. And like right now, this is going to sound insane, but I know it's driven from the same thing. It's waking up at midnight and going, you know what? You need to go to the kitchen and binge on some Haagen-Dazs.
It's noise. The noise is in a different area now.
Yeah. You know, some people it's gambling. Some people it's sex. Some people it's workaholism.
Yeah.
Some people it's overtraining. I mean,
it
never goes away. It just moves, and just hopefully it moves into stuff that's less and less harmful and easier to deal with.
Mine is organizing and getting rid of. It's obsessive. It's insane. I mean, that's mine.
Are you a collector or are you getting rid of?
I'm not a hoarder at all, but Freud would have a field day with me walking into this accidental influencer business and everybody sending me everything.
Boy.
And so there's a curiosity about it. And also I like to purchase. I'm a purchaser of certain things that I do collect. And then I just get overwhelmed by that. We really don't need so much. And why is this all here? And I just want it, you know, but it's definitely not a hoarder. I have the most organized, immaculate house you could imagine, but there's too much incoming, outgoing stuff, you know, that's why I wouldn't be good at really being an interior designer, because it would be too noisy for me to have like objet d'art or candles or art. Like, I don't want like a storage facility of any shit ever. I want it out. So that's exactly. A sickness. Yeah.
No, it's good. I like it.
Yeah. It's a good one. It's not, it's like working out. It's good. Cause I could come into your house and organize it and you'd be so happy.
It's so funny you say that because, again, one of the things about my wife that I remember, you know, when I was actively dating big time, and she was among the people that I was seeing, and she came over and organized my coffee table, the books on my coffee table. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I was like, no one else had done that.
That's nice.
No one else had ever done that.
That's hilarious. Well, your marriage is a big part of your identity too. And you seem to be pretty good at it. No marriage is perfect, but I'm asking if like you've had serious bumps to make us all feel better about our miserable lives, or have you not?
And this is one of the reasons why, you know, to the extent that I ever hesitate to talk about it, the temptation is that, oh, well, it must be perfect. And well, sure, anybody can be married for 33 years if it's perfect and there aren't any struggles or, you know, and that's not the case. I mean, it just isn't, you know, it's no different than a long career.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in a long marriage or if you're in a long career, by definition, you're going to have those fallow periods because nothing in life remains the same. Nothing. Stock market, business, relationships, they all have their ups and downs. And I think the difference is, both in careers and marriages, is how you react when they're down. And that's
amazing point.
And that's the difference. That is literally the difference in a long career, short career, or a long marriage or a short marriage, is what do you do? Do you run? Do you blame? Can you live in acceptance? Can you change? Can the other person change? Can you forgive? Can you take responsibility? All of those things. And a lot of people can't do any of them.
It's a great point. And do you lean in and be like, all right, let's work this thing through? Oh,
we work hard. Listen, we do marriage therapy even when we don't quote unquote need it.
You want to lock the door so you don't get robbed.
It's like, yeah. And you send your car in to get tuned up.
So true. That's really a great note. And so you've had some serious roadblocks. Like you've been canceled in a time when people didn't even get canceled. And yeah. I've thought about, not even since meeting you, I've thought about that in my life. I don't know why, that I don't believe that would even be on the board for cancellation as long. Like things hit differently back then. And so it was looked bad to me overall. On a 1 to 10 of like your career being stratospheric, I envision it that your career was stratospheric. You hit a brick wall and then you were not present for a while. And then all of a sudden you started to slowly come back in different types of things. That's how I perceive it. So how accurate is that?
I would say that that's pretty accurate. I would say that there are two things that I think that add to it, a little more context. One is, I actually think that in many ways, my ill-fated appearance on the Academy Awards did as much damage. I was asked to open the Academy Awards and to do a song with Snow White. And it felt like a really good idea at the time, and it was a terrible idea. It was a badly conceived, it was supposed to be silly and people hated it. And then I think then post all of that, I got sober, went away to rehab, got serious with my wife, got married, moved out of LA, started having kids. So I'm sure it was a sort of a mutual decision in terms of Hollywood and me. Like I spent the 80s building my career, and I spent the 90s building myself.
Wow. So it was the best thing that ever happened to you in ways.
Oh, not in ways. It was the best thing that ever happened to me, full stop.
Do you feel like you were it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy to fail? Do you feel like you were reckless and like kind of looking for something you were looking for a while to hit?
No, 100%. No, I absolutely remember feeling like, the criminal that wants to be arrested. So they can stop.
Wow. So you weren't like, oh, fuck, my career's over, because you make that kind of change. Did you have a backup plan, or did you know you have enough control over who you are and that you're Rob Lowe and that you can come back when you decide? Because most people, like you said, if someone knocks on the door, you're going to sell your house. If you go away, you could be obsolete in the entertainment industry.
I never thought about it in that way. And I, because all I was thinking about at the time when I was getting sober was, it's time for me. I'm doing this for me. I'm not doing it for my career. I'm not doing it for public consumption. I'm not doing it to stay together with my then girlfriend, Cheryl, who became my wife. I was doing it for me. And it was probably the first thing that I ever really did just for me, ever. And it was all I could think about. It required everything. And anything else that bubbled up around it, like, what about my career? What about it? I was like, don't care.
Right.
We'll let the chips fall where they may. Who knows? I'm doing
it. It's funny. Matthew McConaughey made a similar, I don't know if you read his book, Green Lights, but he made a similar decision about, like, I'm not taking these like shirtless rom-coms. Right. And he stood tight. He just knew there was a moment when he had to do something. And that was my moment, was leaving The Housewives. As ridiculous as that sounds, it was millions of dollars. And it was, you know, my business manager said, or someone said, trees grow high. They don't grow high to the sky. Take the millions of dollars right now until you can't get it anymore. And I made decision to intervene and just like, this is like, I've got to reinvent and do everything differently now. And it's a nice feeling, and people have to be in tune and aware and courageous enough to do that.
And to hear the, but also to hear the voice inside of them and honor that. And
yes.
Then you have to be courageous on top of that to do it.
What age was that at that you did that?
26.
That was young to be making those kind of big boy decisions, to be like going to rehab and getting married. That was you peaked early.
Well, you know, I had a lot of life. I had more life experience than the average 26-year-old. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. I'd been more, done more, seen more, learned more. And, but yes, looking back on it, it's younger than any of my kids are now.
Yeah, totally.
And I look back on it and go, what the hell?
So Lorne Michaels once said to me at dinner, he was talking about somebody else on SNL or something. It didn't apply. It wasn't about me, but I just never forget it. He said, you have to make an exit to be able to make an entrance.
It's one of my favorite Lorne-isms.
The last two questions I have, people have given me one piece of advice, like, I don't fix them, I fix me. Or every day we check in once a day. These things that I sometimes say, oh God, well, I don't do that. Like, what is your thing that you guys do that seems simple to you, but would help other people in relationships?
Well, there's two things. The number one thing is, let's hope you've chosen right to begin with, because really the die is cast with who you choose. Because as you allude to in the advice, you can't change another person. Changing yourself is hard. It's like Cheryl and I are simpatico on so many things: money, politics, where we want to go on vacations.
Mm.
Uniforms are not uniforms in schools. I mean, you name it.
Got it.
Name the list of from the banal to the really intense. And I am going to be on the exact same page with her all the time. Now, we happen to disagree on something very important to me: comedy. Cheryl Lowe does not understand comedy. She doesn't.
And what do you mean she doesn't understand comedy? Like, does she not think you are funny? Because I know couples where one person's funny and the other person doesn't think they're funny. Does she think you're funny?
She's smart enough to know that other people think I'm funny.
See?
Yes. No, she doesn't. She's a horrible laugh for me. She's a black hole.
Oh my God.
In my one man shows. And it's a running joke amongst our friends and family. So, like, by the way, for some people, that would be a barrier to entry.
100%. I'm a comedy snob. And would you think she funny?
No.
See? And
here's another thing. And I had one girlfriend in particular. All we did was laugh. God, I loved it. It was fucking amazing. But you know what? It's fine. It's she would have been, by the way, a terrible wife and a terrible life partner. Right? You know, she also doesn't like Bruce Springsteen. And her music, I feel like I can feel the pot smoke in the air when I listen to the music.
That's my fiance, Paul. Same. It's like Fish and Grateful Dead. Yeah. And it's funny, but the music and the comedy, those aren't what I call, in a book that I wrote called I Suck at Relationships So You Don't Have To, fundamental differences. I believe you can't have fundamental differences by and large, like the things right. that, you know, just like you said, the way you parent, money, things like that, like values, core values. And then the last question is, what was your rose and your thorn of your career?
Ooh. I think the rose continues to be the rose, which is for whatever reason, I have been able to plant my flag in the comedy world and the drama world. And I also have not been pigeonholed in that I can do funny commercials for DirecTV. And I can do a serious drama in the West End in London, and I can produce and do a game show. I kind of get to do whatever. I can write best-selling books. I can kind of do whatever I think is interesting and that I'm going to learn from, without it bumping people and people going, "What the hell?" and people accepting it. So to me, that's if there's a rose, that's the rose. And the thorn, probably, I mean, I'm such an optimist. It's hard for me to even think of what the thorn is. I don't know. I think the thorn is more systemic. And I think the thorn is just that the business is so much harder than it's ever been.
Mm.
It's harder on every level.
And you work hard because it's just who you are. You're not necessarily working towards something. Like, you're just always setting new goals and you just like to work. It's the journey.
It's for sure the journey. I mean, I think the minute you think and go, well, I've done it. Or, well, I never allow myself to. I feel exactly the same as I did at the beginning of my career, other than I also will allow myself to look back and see how far I've come.
We're the same age. I think you got a second wind, because I got a second wind. Like, sometimes you think maybe it's a little exhausting and I want to rest a little and I maybe near done. And I don't know if that's like self-defense or something, you know what I mean? Self-protection. But I've caught a big wind and it feels good. And I think it's this age, you know, it's like not a midlife crisis. It's just like a reinvigoration and really fine tuning, like sharpening the knife. So you don't have to waste time swimming with your arms and legs, wasting all this energy. You're like right hooked in.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is I definitely experience and life has gotten me to a place where I also really know where I'm valuable and what my value is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not suffering fools anymore. Mm-hmm. I never really did. And I know, even though I'm super diverse in what I'm interested in, I also know my lane, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Sounds counterintuitive, but I really know like what moves the needle for me.
Well, that's kind of what I mean. You don't need to fuck around and waste time. Like, you know what you're supposed to do. You'll take chances if you're inspired, but like, it's a quality versus quantity model. Yeah, I love it.
Exactly.
I love meeting you, talking to you, and knowing you.
You and vice versa.
Really. So we're friends now. And you when are. I'm in Santa Barbara, I'm coming over.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I'll show you the real estate. I mean, you need, as they say, a footprint over here, I think.
Yes, I do. I love it. My daughter loves it. So amazing talking to you. Thank you for having me on your show, and thank you for coming on mine, and give my love to your family.
I will. And this was great. It was so fun to be a guest.
It's different for you.
Oh my God. This is the best. I mean,
you're a good guest. You're a very good guest.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I haven't lost it by being a host for so long now.
No, you're a very good host and you're a very good guest. So that's awesome. Yeah, really good. That's why I wanted to talk forever. You're just a very good guest. So thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. It's great being here.
I was on Rob Lowe's podcast and I really liked him. He's a good talker. He's a good listener. He's evolved. He is emotionally intelligent. He is a hard worker. He's very inspirational. And I really, really enjoyed doing his podcast. And I'm honored and humbled that he wanted to do mine, you know, as a result of that conversation. Because I do think that sometimes people think I'm just some nitwit reality star. And there are just some times that people come on and I feel like I'm not worthy. And it was exciting to have him on. And I thought he was extraordinary, as good a guest as he is a host.
So Puerto Rico is a beautiful place. It's a lush island. It's great for surfing. It's got a culture. Like, you feel like you've really gone somewhere far and you don't need a passport, which honestly, I do really enjoy. It's a beautiful island. The people are amazing. The food is amazing. The water, the beaches, the vibe. It's a great place. It really is. In Puerto Rico, you'll taste the influence of Spanish, African, and native Taino traditions, sometimes all in the same dish. Puerto Rican chefs and restaurants put their passion into every bite. Puerto Rico is an excellent destination for food, which may not be a well-known fact. Whether it's a five-star restaurant or local favorite spot, no one does food like Puerto Rico. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.